Today on Vox Talks Economics, one way in which economic development might be creating conflict too. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. This week, another one of the most interesting presentations from the CEPR Paris School of Economics Symposium 2024. Economic development, especially in Africa, often implies improving crop agriculture and then maybe even that'll kickstart a structural transformation for the entire economy. But many rural populations have lived for thousands of years in a way that doesn't easily fit this narrative. So is the good news for crop farmers maybe also a threat to their traditional way of life? Owen McGurk of Tufts has found evidence of how this development mismatch, as he calls it, implies different outcomes for different groups and is maybe even creating conflict between them. He joins me now. Owen, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hello, Tim. Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Owen, that model of economic development that I sketched out above, why is it so pervasive?
Yeah, so you can kind of think of it as a description of the development process rather than a model. Mm-hmm. We all started agrarian, and countries that are today very wealthy did so by industrializing. So as development economists, we're very interested in that sort of first step of structural transformation. How does a society go from being agrarian, maybe even subsistence agriculture, to high-value manufacturing? And there are tons of open questions on that process, but it's generally understood that an important step is improving productivity in crop agriculture, right? So going from subsistence agriculture to sort of more capital-intensive, mechanized agriculture that generates a surplus. So this is a very promising area for development aid. It can directly improve the livelihoods of farmers and farming households, of course. But on top of that, it can also generate these conditions that are potentially conducive to industrialization. And what's very interesting about this from an African perspective is Africa did not enjoy a green revolution. Mm-hmm. So yields in Africa just didn't take off in the way that we saw them take off in the 20th century in places like India and China, Philippines and the Americas. And on top of that, maybe more than half of workers in Africa are engaged in agriculture. A high share of those are living in poverty. So you can imagine for those who are stuck in low yield subsistence crop agriculture, these modern crop development projects are potentially very valuable, you know, maybe even transformative.
But you focus in this work on what are known as transhuman populations instead, who don't show up in this step of the story. They're not part of it. Who are they? And how common is this method of subsistence?
In Africa, for about a fifth of the population, crop agriculture is not the prevailing mode of subsistence at all. Uh-huh. It's pastoralism, right? So these are people who get most of their income from animal husbandry, from managing livestock. And this is something that takes place on about 43% of Africa's landmass. So you can imagine it happening on these really large tracts of semi-arid land that's just not very productive for anything else. A decent share of these, we don't have a good number, but a decent share of these, particularly of those who have large animals, are what's called transhuman, as you say. So this means that they migrate, they move with their large animals in search of grazing pasture. And this is a mode of subsistence that emerged as a strategy to deal with rising aridity, rising dryness about 7,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the basic economic logic is that rather than relying on rainfall to occur over a specific plot of land, well, why don't you instead follow the rainfall? Because your assets have legs. So you can think of it as a method of extracting value from a semi-arid area that is risky for farming or just not productive for any other means. And the key component of the production function is mobility. Moving around within the wet season in these semi-arid areas in search of rain, and then after the wet season, leaving the region altogether, finding somewhere to graze for the dry season.
And if they are moving around, then how is it that they have access to these migration routes and the land that they use?
The critical component of this and what makes the whole thing work is mutual cooperation with adjacent farmers. So once the dry season kicks in and the semi-arid area just won't produce enough plant biomass to sustain the herds, they go to adjacent farmland and they occupy farmland after the harvest for the duration of the dry season. And this is something that benefits both groups, right? This is the symbiotic relationship, or what we'd say in economics, complementarities in production. The idea is farmers aren't farming after the harvest, so the herders get to graze their animals, that suits them. But because the animals are on that ground, they're providing sort of nitrogen-rich organic fertilizer, and that's going to make farming more productive in the next year. So it's this mutual agreement that sustains crop agriculture and transhuman pastoralism in these regions.
Owen, how do the crop farmers view this other group, and how do policymakers think about them?
This is an interesting point. Historically, pastoral groups are fairly peripheral, right? They're peripheral when it comes to politics. They rarely hold much political power. They're also literally peripheral, right? They operate in the margins on sort of marginal land near border areas. From the perspective of states and from international organizations and maybe even some NGOs, there's this traditional belief that pastoralism is maybe a little bit backward, and that pastoralists themselves are in need of modernizing or civilizing or something like that. So that's where these crop agriculture development projects come back into it. These are projects that, from the perspective of the state, not only will they increase yields, but they might also be a useful tool to sedentarize these pastoral people, to make them settle down where you can manage them better, or at the very least, tax them more easily. What's important to understand in all of this, the backdrop in Africa, is we are seeing sharply increased conflict between herders and farmers. This mutual arrangement seems to be under a lot of stress, and that's a very important question for researchers to understand. Why are these groups who benefit from each other's production suddenly fighting so much? My co-author in this project, Nathan Nunn, and I, we have an earlier project looking at climate change, right? So climate change is one reason why we're seeing more violence between these groups. But in researching that project, we learned a lot about these crop agricultural development projects as well. From the perspective of pastoralists, these are viewed as agricultural encroachment. These are projects that are being implemented in pastoral areas. They're potentially blocking access to really important water points, to pasture. At their very worst, these are projects that might displace pastoral groups altogether. So there seems to be a belief on the pastoral side that these projects are not designed to include pastoralists, they're designed to displace them. What we set out to do in this paper is we want to figure out, are these unrepresentative anecdotes, or is this something that's representative of the data at large?
At the 2023 PSE CEPR Symposium, Esther Duflo had some strong views about the challenges for economic development, what the problems are, and how we should solve them. Listen to our episode, Duflo, Development in the 21st Century, broadcast in July 2023.
As you say, your work is focusing on whether these crop agricultural development projects are going to lead to conflict in areas that are traditionally used by pastoral farmers. So which areas, which territories are we thinking about here?
Yeah, so for this, we use historical ethnographic data that gives us kind of a snapshot of the late pre-colonial era of where these pastoralists are located. Okay, so They're located in parts of countries that sweep across the Sahara, north and south, and all the way across the Sahel from West Africa, right into the Horn of Africa, into Ethiopia and Somalia, down into parts of Kenya, and also around the Namib Desert in the southwest.
And to do this, you have to look at the impact across a region rather than following what happens in one particular project or program, don't you? So what data can you use for this, and for what years can you get that data?
We're fortunate that we have access to data that is continent-wide on all of our key variables, right? So we begin by creating this grid of about 10,000 cells that covers the entire continent. These are 0.5 degree cells. That's about 55 kilometers by 55 kilometers. And we observe all of our key variables over a 20-year period from 1995 to 2014. So the first thing we can do is we can determine whether or not a cell is in a traditionally pastoral area. That's using the ethnographic data that I mentioned. The second thing we can do is we can observe whether or not a civil conflict event happens in one of these cells in a given year. We have two data sources for that. There's UCDP from Uppsala and ACLED, the Armed Conflict Location Event Dataset. And then the third component is we get to take advantage of this really detailed, clean data on World Bank development projects. So this is organized by the Aid Data Initiative at William and Mary College in the US. Mm-hmm. We can see about 15,000 projects located in different years across different cells in Africa over that 20-year period. And 4,000 of these are in crop agriculture. So these are geocoded. We have nice off-the-shelf labels, and that makes them very useful for what we're doing. And the key sort of question we're asking is, what happens when you put one of these crop agriculture projects in a non-pastoral area? So you can think of that as being matched. And what happens when you put it in a pastoral area? Think of that as being mismatched. And how do those effects differ from one another?
So tell me, what does happen then if you put them, first of all, in a non-pastoral area? What is the impact on the likelihood of violence?
When you put them in the non-pastoral area, they seem to live up to the promise. So we see a very large decrease in the risk of violence. It falls by about 55%. And not only that, we see an increase in economic activity by about 24%. Okay, so we're using night lights that are visible from space to measure economic activity. So very consistent with the idea that these matched projects can lead to really rapid improvements in well-being, a sharp decline in violence and an increase in productivity.
Yeah, these are great numbers, and they're not small numbers either. But is the result different when the projects take place in these pastoral areas?
Well, this is where the largest number comes into it, to your point. So the key finding in our paper is we see something very, very different when the project is mismatched, right? So when you put this crop agricultural project in a traditionally pastoral area, we see the risk of conflict increasing by almost 190%. So it almost triples in the typical pastoral area. So a really, really huge estimate. That's quite striking.
And is this all about the presence of crop agriculture? Because it's such a huge number. Or is conflict always more likely when some kind of development is going on?
What's, again, very helpful for us in the development aid data set is we don't only observe crop agriculture projects. There's this whole residual group of projects that we can just call non-agricultural. So that could be education, it could be health, communication, transport, whatever it is, energy, those types of projects. When you put those non-agricultural projects in pastoral areas, nothing happens. There's no difference in the effect on conflict between pastoral and non-pastoral areas. We can rule out that this is caused by just the presence of the state in a pastoral area or an aid project or the World Bank or anything like that. It's something that is completely specific to crop agriculture projects in pastoral areas.
Oh, and is it a conflict over territory because these areas that were used for grazing are now being used for crops? Or is it a conflict about beliefs that these are different types of populations and suddenly they are in competition with each other?
Yeah, so the evidence is definitely consistent with the case study motivation for the paper. That these are projects that, for whatever reason, are not benefiting pastoralists, and they're harming existing pastoral systems and they're displacing pastoral groups. On the issue of beliefs, there is a curiosity that ends up being quite informative here. So anyone who studies conflict in Africa will know that jihadist conflict, so conflict involving jihadist groups, has been really on the rise. In the early 2000s, this was close to 0% of all conflict in Africa, and now it's almost 50%.
Yeah.
And that's not just the Sahel, that's the entire continent. Now, it just so happens that among pastoral groups, there are about twice as many Muslims as there are Christians, and that's due to history and geography. And among non-pastoral groups, it's the other way around, maybe twice as many Christians as Muslims. So any mechanism or any shock like what we're studying here that generates conflict between farmers and herders might also mechanically generate conflict between people from different religions. And something that arises from the case study literature is that this is fertile ground for jihadist groups to recruit vulnerable young men. So think of a young pastoral man who's been displaced. This is someone who's highly vulnerable to recruitment by a jihadist group. And this is something we can check in the data. So we can separate the conflict into events involving jihadist groups and events that don't involve jihadist groups. And what we find is just something very, very similar, no matter what the type of conflict is, right? It has an almost exactly the same quantitative effect on jihadist conflict as it does a non-jihadist conflict. And what's particularly interesting about that finding is we can control for religion. So we can control for the share of people from whatever religion or in whichever area. So it's not the case that you're putting an agricultural project in a place with Muslim people. It's that you're putting it in a pastoral area and that happens to be correlated with Islam. It's something about access to land and economic resources rather than some sort of atavistic religious hatred that seems to be driving this conflict.
Well, the headline news from these crop agriculture development projects is so amazing, so positive. But yet what you have discovered is so negative. We really need to find some way to solve this problem, don't we? So, I mean, I guess one way to do it might be to include the pastoralists who've always been, as you say, on the edge in these development projects. Could this reduce conflict? Is it possible?
So there are some encouraging findings even within the bad news part of these results.
Right.
You know, as I mentioned earlier, these projects have these off-the-shelf labels that are very useful for us. And one label that some of them have is that they're also used for what's called animal production. So we can think of these as pastoral projects. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that one in every, you know, maybe six or seven crop agriculture projects also has a pastoral project connected to it, bundled with the pastoral project. For these projects, we see completely the opposite effect. In other words, it mutes the effect of crop agriculture projects on conflict in pastoral areas, brings it back to a very tightly estimated zero. This gives us some insight into how we can avoid the conflict that is due to this mismatch. If you bundle the crop agriculture project with the pastoral project, the effect goes away. And not to start doing your job, Tim, but the natural question that comes after this is, well, when does that happen, right? So why is it that, you know, one in every seven of these has a pastoral project? And for this, we looked at political power. We know from the conflict literature that minority groups who are in opposition have strong incentives to fight if there's no political power sharing. So the question we ask here is, well, what happens when pastoral groups have more political power? Do we see a different allocation of these aid projects? And that's exactly what we see. When pastoralists have more political power, you're more likely to see these pastoral projects bundled with the crop agriculture projects in pastoral areas. And that comes at the expense of non-agricultural projects. So it's like they're trading off the non-agricultural projects and they're assigning more well-matched pastoral projects to pastoral areas, and this reduces conflict. That's a potentially encouraging and informative result that can guide some policy solutions.
You look historically, Owen, and many places in the world used to have these populations who moved their animals around. It used to happen in the UK or across Europe as well. And gradually those populations died out and people settled. Could this process happen in Africa as part of economic development? We just will not see these populations anymore and therefore the conflict will die out?
It's very plausible that pastoralism could shrink as a share of the labor force for the exact same reason that agriculture shrinks as a share of the labor force when a country gets rich, right? So in the places in the world with the most productive agricultural sectors, they're the countries that have the smallest share of workers in agriculture. So think of any OECD country. You can imagine a hopeful future where pastoralism becomes much more productive, where pastoral development is taken very, very seriously, as crop agricultural development is, and where there is a surplus generated. This is part of kickstarting that structural transformation we talked about in the beginning. And then for those who want to migrate to cities and take up jobs in the manufacturing sector, that becomes an attractive option for them. That's very, very plausible. However, we discussed a few minutes ago how pastoralism emerged. It emerged as a response to rising aridity. And we're now back in an era of rising aridity. Mm-hmm. And pastoralism is a highly resilient way of dealing with uncertain rainfall in semi-arid areas. And these semi-arid areas in Africa are not shrinking, they're growing.
Yes.
So just as this could decline in the long run as countries develop, you can imagine a countervailing force in the short run where pastoralism becomes a way to deal with and a way to adapt to climate change, particularly in areas that, you know, maybe were suitable for agriculture, so grassland areas that are now becoming drier, that are now becoming semi-arid, that can't sustain crop agriculture, but that could sustain pastoralism. So it might persist for longer than we would otherwise think it would.
In these areas, you're likely to find crop farmers who are under pressure to make a living and might try and expand the amount of land that they have under cultivation into those areas traditionally used by pastoral farmers. So there is a scenario here where we end up, through climate change, with more conflict than ever.
The first paper in this series that Nathan and I wrote was on that very mechanism, linking climate change to farmer-herder conflict. And the idea was that it was climate change in pastoral areas leading to conflict in these farming areas because of that early migration. And then in the current paper that we're discussing today, it's about the sort of encroachment of agriculture into pastoral areas leading to conflict. No matter which way you look at it, it seems very clear that we need new methods to deal with resolving conflict and resolving differences over land use. and getting the right balance of cultivation and grazing rights in a way that sustains that mutually beneficial relationship and gets us back to that peaceful equilibrium rather than these frictions that we're seeing now. I think there's huge scope for policy work and for research in this area. There seems to be a very important role for institutions that can update land use rights, that can bring the coordination that these groups need to find a shared use of these resources and to generate more inclusive decision-making processes. It is encouraging to see that there is quite a lot happening on the policy side. So the World Bank has just started its second phase of a program called PRAPS in the Sahel. So that's to deal with countries in West Africa dealing with these problems. It's a very intensive pastoral development project. They're kickstarting another one called DRIVE in East Africa, again, to support pastoral populations and to manage sharing resources between pastoral and agricultural populations. And I think it's a very fruitful area for researchers, for economists, for political scientists to study the effect of these programs and to keep learning about what can avoid conflict and what can be conducive to development.
Let's hope that we learn quickly. Owen, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
The paper is called Development Mismatch: Evidence from Agricultural Projects in Pastoral Africa. Authors: Owen McGurk and Nathan Nunn.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We have more than 300 episodes now covering every type of economics. So subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and make us your summer listening. Next week on Vox Talks, do billionaires pay taxes?